First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
City officials doubled down on maps a judge threw out as new candidates qualify to run for office. One Duval High School cancels a play, and the playwright slams the decision. And go Jags! Excitement builds for this weekend's big playoff game. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the biggest stories of the week with our Friday roundtable, and you can join us, be part of it. The number, 549-2937. Then later, why NASA and NOAA are sounding the alarm about our warming planet with new data about just how hot 2022 was. That's later. But first, it's Friday, and here, decked out in their Jaguar gear to round up all the week's news, we welcome regular contributor Charles Griggs. Hey, Charles.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. Claire Goforth of the Daily Dot.
Good morning.
Mike Mendenhall of the Jack's Daily Record. Good morning, Melissa. And joining us on Zoom, Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union. Hey, Nate.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to see you all. This show is live on the radio, and you can also watch us live on video on Facebook and YouTube. Check out our Jaguars gear. It's that time. We'll be talking about the game later. But let's begin with our top story. The city of Jacks has potentially paid more than $150,000 in fees to law firms and consultants as it tried to draw and defend city council district maps. That's according to a Times Union review. Now, the hour-by-hour accounts of work done by the lawyers and consultants shown in these invoices raise new questions about the city's communications with their hired guns and how big a factor race played during the map drawing process. As some of you out there have been following along, what the city has been engaged in an expensive and controversial legal battle since the summer over which map should be used for both city council and school board districts. At the same time, new candidates are qualifying right now to run for March elections in the newly redrawn districts. The election is in just a couple of months. So we're going to begin the hour with a closer look at this, and the number to join us, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Facebook open, as always. Nate Monroe, let's begin with you. These numbers in the Times Union being reported, tell us what you found out, you and your colleagues.
Yeah, so my colleague Hannah requested the invoices that the city has been paying for an outside sort of specialty law firm and this redistricting consultant that have been helping the council shepherd through a remedial map after Judge Howard had struck down the original map that they had passed. That remedial map failed. And so this money, I think, can sort of fairly question whether this $150,000 in various legal and consulting fees has been a wise choice. But they show that the consultant, a really critical issue in this legal case is what role race played in the drawing of these maps. And one representation that the consultant made to the city council was that he had drawn these maps and did not review racial data until after these maps had been created. Some of the invoices and some of the hourly billing, I think potentially undercuts those representations that he made to the council. It actually looks like he did review city demographic data in the lead up to drawing these maps, and that he reviewed some of the data that the plaintiffs, these various civil rights groups, had been filing in the court record, and that would include racial data as well. And so some of these invoices, I think, contain, some new questions about, some of the representations that were made to the council, in addition to the $150,000 cost.
549-2937. Charles Griggs, let's remind people that the city has been fighting for months now after a federal judge has repeatedly struck them down and called the maps they drew for themselves racially gerrymandered. Voters are going to go to the polls in March. It appears under new political lines. The judge has remade the political map, siding with civil rights groups who had brought this federal lawsuit. And already candidates are rushing to qualify for these new political districts. Just the other day, we had on prominent attorney and Folio Weekly publisher John Phillips, who's running in the newly created District 7. We hope to have some other candidates who are running for office. People are rushing to take advantage of this new political terrain, I guess, is a good way to put it.
Yeah, as awkward as it may sound or weird, whatever you want to call it, for whatever reason, the city felt necessary to defend their process of creating these maps. And, you know, we may feel like it's, you know, they wasted a lot of money and time. For some reason, they feel like that, you know, they were doing the will of the people in terms of the process they used in order to get to what they considered to be fair maps. Because, the organizations, the plaintiffs in this case, prevailed under these circumstances, it should probably send a signal that the process was flawed, right? And and they probably should have done something a little more to get the people in the community to feel more comfortable with the way the original maps or the ones that they put forward were drawn. But now we have a free for all, right? So people are coming out everywhere to kind of run for some of these offices. It is a fresh take on how business is done in terms of who may or may qualify or wanted to run for office in their community. It looks like we're probably going to be adding maybe one more democratically held seat there from a district representation there. And at the same time, that can be a motivation for people to step, put their hat in the ring if they feel like they have an opportunity to win. And we're seeing some of that because of things, not as much as some folks would like to see, but we're seeing some, shifting of the chairs out here so folks can have an opportunity to run for office.
I'll put this question to callers. I've asked this before. Are you voting in the March elections? Do you even know your city council district? It might have changed. Do you know who your city council representative is? Do you know who the candidates for mayor are? Are you going to vote for mayor? Are you voting at all? Did you even know there was an election in March? Give us a call at 549-2937. Claire Goforth, it's a March election, and then it will go to a May runoff election for most of these candidates. It's a low turnout affair that tends to benefit incumbents, of course. But with these new maps, that does provide a little crack of daylight, as Charles said, for some new faces to try to jump in.
It certainly does. You know, what we've seen for many years in Jacksonville is a preservation of the status quo when it comes to city council. The next challenger tends to be somebody who's anointed and just expected to win and ultimately does. By having this new map, maybe we'll see a little bit of a change, a little bit of shakeup on the council. You know, and to Charles's point, to say that, the council made the argument they were doing the will of the people, but in reality, they were doing the will of the incumbents. And they even went so far as to brazenly argue that that's what they were doing in court. And I think that to many voters, that says that their interests really didn't lie in trying to create fair maps that had a representative government in Jacksonville, so much as it was to keep their jobs. And that's really not the way democracy is supposed to function. And I think that one of the reasons why we see lower turnout and why we see people who are out there right now they're Googling, who is my city council representative?
Most people probably don't
know.
They're
going and looking it up because they don't know. And they don't know because there's just been no incentive for them to be engaged in the process. So hopefully having a new map will actually encourage more voter turnout and involvement.
You can look at the new maps on our website. Other media outlets have published the new maps. You can go to DuvalElections.com to learn more about your part of town, the candidates who filed, Mike Mendenhall. Unfortunately, you do have to do a little bit of research to figure all this out if you want to go out and vote.
Yeah, Melissa, and it is a little confusing right now for potential candidates that want to file as well as voters. I mean, and if you let for an example, Reggie Gaffney Jr., who's currently the representing District 7, he ran in a special election a few months ago. He's now going to be running in District 8. Brenda Priestley Jackson, who represents District 10, she announced yesterday on social media that she wasn't going to run again, and she cited the the judge's decision and the maps. And so you're having a lot of these last minute moves. And it's also creating a headache for the supervisor of elections office too. Mm-hmm. You know, having to make sure that all the correct
information. I don't envy him right now.
I don't think anybody would want his job at the moment. But
he's got to figure all this out, make sure everyone's voting in the correct district.
Yep,
and make voter education the whole thing.
Exactly, and it has to be done within a very short amount of time. You know, qualifying ends today at noon for these candidates, and it's too. I mean, the longer this process draws out too, with the city council, you know, still arguing the remedial maps in court. I mean, it's still it becomes harder and harder for people to understand what's at stake and who's going to be on the ballot.
Let's try to answer your questions. Join us 549-2937. Wendy in Jacksonville. Hi, Wendy. Good morning.
Hey, Melissa. Hi. It's Wendy Tatter, and I just wondered if you knew that Molière Dumont is running for mayor in Orlando.
Oh, no, I didn't know that, because we're mainly focused on Jacksonville races. But do you have any thoughts about Jacksonville?
No, I just thought you might be surprised and interested because you had Molière on the show, and
sure.
I thought you might think that was interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
That's all I have to say.
Yeah, he's an interesting activist that we have interviewed in the past. Thank you for that. And, you know, we do focus, I should give a shameless plug, on statewide issues on the Florida Roundup, which is our live statewide call-in program that airs every Friday at noon. So we'll be back at noon for that show. Here now, though, we will just be talking local politics. So I'll ask this again. Do you know your city council district? It makes me think of that old Colbert Report segment. Better know a district, where he tried to educate people about all of the congressional districts,
right. Yeah, mm-hmm.
because most people don't know who their congressman is. Mm-hmm. And so I'm assuming most people around town don't know who their city council representative is, and it's going to potentially change. So let us know, what are your questions about this election, your district, your representative, 549-2937. Richard on the west side. Hi, Richard.
Hi, this is not regarding districting, although I think you're doing a great job. I had a question or comment regarding the death of Mr. Sturman, who had been given a special access card to the jail by Mr. Rutherford. This was apparently, you know,
Or former Sheriff Mike Williams. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. I wonder why nobody is covering why a GOP operative is given full and unfettered access to the most sensitive information about Jacksonville citizens. And I don't want to sound like a conspiracy nut, but it looks an awful lot like a political operation inside the GOP-led government of Jacksonville and probably other localities as well.
Thanks, Richard. You know, we have covered that, and we plan to continue to find out more if we're able to. And what he's talking about, Nate Monroe, is the suicide of a prominent local GOP donor, Kent Sturman, his company, Total Military Management. And it emerged in the wake of his tragic death that he had been given unfettered access to JSO with his own security badge, his own parking space. He was going along on ride-alongs with police. This was all under the tenure of former Sheriff Mike Williams. The new sheriff, T.K. Waters, essentially shut Sturman out shortly before he died. And this is an ongoing story. We're still trying to learn more about this, Nate.
Right, we are. And as you said, I mean, this has gotten actually tons of coverage in the last, you know, several weeks in the run up to the holidays. Sturman at the time of his death was under a criminal investigation related to some sexual misconduct allegations. And we are still waiting to learn more about that. There have not been any updates, but I'm sure that that's also going to be something widely covered.
That's right. And you know, Charles, whether it's that tragic and shocking story or whether it's other incidents of alleged corruption in this city, a number of candidates that are going to be on the ballot are going to most likely be campaigning on a message of, let's clean this city up. Let's root out corruption, right, cronyism, conflicts of interest, which right, are rampant. Yeah. Let's have a more ethical city government.
Right. We'll see the three consistent talking points. Clean up government, keep a safe, you know, keep the city safe, and low taxes.
You know, which is hard to do all three at the same time.
We'll hear probably every candidate have some variation of those three talking points during the campaign. There'll be, you know, we'll see creative ways to get that message out. But the problem is we only have, you know, like 2 months now before the election, before the primary. And, you know, that's very hard to do with, you know, all of these people in the mix, you know, a lot of noise in the system, and very few candidates with enough money to get that done. So, you know, hopefully we can get some, have some real conversations, have some real, you know, conversations about issues in the community, things that need to get done, especially in individual neighborhoods and communities. But time is of the essence, and candidates are trying to, you know, find their place and find their pace in order to get their messages out.
Yeah, this successful lawsuit has changed the game in that sense. Claire?
It certainly has. And I did take note with great interest that when News for Jax recently asked voters what matters to them in the upcoming election, of course, they hit crime and, you know, taxes. But they also mentioned downtown development and stadium upgrades as important issues to them. I think that stadium upgrades, we could argue, goes to fiscal responsibility. Maybe some people are concerned that we're giving too much money to the Jaguars, and that we have other priorities that we should focus on. I think that economic disparity is going to be something that's going to be an undercurrent in some of these races, and maybe possibly also the JSEB process, the Jacksonville Small and Emerging Business process by which contracts are awarded in the city. It's long been criticized for how it's conducted and that some people abuse the process. And that has been a continuing chorus that you hear over the years among candidates and people engaged in these issues. So while like the big ones will probably be crime, taxes, those things, I think that some of these fringier issues are going to have a bigger role in this election and maybe elections in the future.
Mike Mendenhall.
Yeah, I think Claire's absolutely right. And I think that pretty much every city council candidate and every mayoral candidate is probably going to have to answer the question, do you support a full renovation or new stadium for the Jaguars? And, you know, how much are you willing to for the taxpayers to contribute?
Yeah.
And the Jaguars have made very clear that that's the direction they're going. Mayor Curry has said that they're in the beginning stages of working with the Jaguars on this. So, I mean, the ball is already rolling. So whoever enters the mayor's office, you know, in I guess July 1, will have to, you know, tackle this. And I think it is, you know, the city has allotted a lot of money to downtown development, especially in the last couple of years. There's new programs have come up that has pumped a lot of money into a historic preservation, historic renovation of downtown buildings. But it is expensive to get the downtown core, you know, moving. However, at the same time, a lot of people, I think it's fair to ask, like a lot of people feel like we're giving this money to developers, but what about the folks that are in the neighborhoods? What about, mm-hmm, you know, the infrastructure that has been long neglected? You know, I mean, is there a balance there, or do we need to prioritize more?
Nate Monroe, what about that? And also the city in an amended agreement giving Jaguars owner Shad Khan's development company more than $129 million to build a Four Seasons Hotel on the north bank of the St. John's River and make other sports complex improvements. But there's this clawback provision. If it turns out the Four Seasons never puts down stakes here, the city's got to get some of that money back, because city council members are hearing from the public, they're skeptical that a Four Seasons will ever actually be built here on the backs of their tax dollars.
Yeah, you know, the Jaguars get very frustrated and prickly when people ask them about this Four Seasons project. And when people, it's a very reasonable question to ask, you know, what is the status of this, you know, alleged agreement with the Four Seasons? Like, how do we know that they're coming here beyond just various Jaguars officials saying, take our word for it, they're coming here? You know, they have had this development agreement in hand since 2021. We're in 2023. And nothing has really changed on that front. I mean, they haven't presented a letter of intent. They haven't presented any sort of written agreement with the Four Seasons. And so the city council reacted to that and said, look, if this is going to be a Four Seasons, as you say, and we'll believe you, then a clawback provision shouldn't be an issue. This should be pretty straightforward. I think that there was a little bit of pushback from the Jaguars, but I mean, it's kind of hard to argue with that logic, right? And so I think that was a good development, despite the fact that the city is now going to be spending more money. There is a little bit of accountability worked into the agreement now, and it is important to get that accountability on the front end, because we're talking about a project that won't be open until 2026. You know, by that time, I mean, there will be a new mayor, new council members. People who live here now may not live here then. I mean, people aren't going to remember if that hotel ends up being something that it's not, that it's not being represented as today. So, you know, you've got to work that stuff in on the front end.
It's our Friday roundtable, as we talk about the biggest stories of the week with Nate Monroe, Charles Griggs, Claire Goforth, Mike Mendenhall, and yours truly. We're going to talk about some other news and notes now. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Okay. Also making headlines this week, this caught a lot of attention. The author of a play that was canceled last week at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts is condemning the choice as what she calls a way to police the sexuality of students and stifle their LGBTQ identity. Noted playwright Paula Vogel slammed the decision by DA to cancel a production of her show Indecent and instead do a production of Siegel. In a statement to PEN America, Vogel said, quote, "I'm not in the business of politics, but whatever the school board says in terms of statements that they've released about why they're doing this, they're putting sheep's clothing over a wolf. And the wolf is Governor DeSantis," she says. Now, Douglas Anderson High says it stopped production on Indecent because of concerns about its mature content. The show includes a lesbian kiss and, ironically enough, is about censorship. It retells events surrounding the 1923 censorship on Broadway of a play called God of Vengeance. So we're going to talk now about the political climate in Florida as Douglas Anderson cancels a production of Indecent, greatly upsetting some of the students involved who posted about the decision on social media. And the decision is drawing condemnation from the playwright herself. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Let us know what you think about this. Charles Griggs, the playwright, and I'm quoting from her statement, said, "Censorship of the arts is always the first step towards totalitarianism." She's criticizing the climate in Florida over what educators can talk about in class or even on a theater stage when it comes to sexuality, race. Now, on the other hand, Douglas Anderson is saying they just felt that the play was a little too mature, even though everyone involved in the play and their parents signed consent forms. We've been hearing about this for about a week or two now. What are your thoughts?
Well, I can tell you, my son graduated from Douglas Anderson about 15 years ago, and I can tell you that I've seen worse during his time. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were much more liberal about how they went about their business, performances they did, they put on.
They used to even show partial nudity in some productions.
It was an environment where students were allowed to create and be creative. This is a highly charged political climate here in Florida.
Yeah.
The overtones probably within, you know, we've seen the not only the district, but the schools themselves restrict themselves so they won't get in any trouble with the governor's office. And this is probably one of those situations where the principal felt like she had her hands tied and didn't want to get the school or administration in any hot water and was going to find a way to err on the side of caution. But, you know, you have to ask yourself, does this do more harm than good? Because now that everyone knows about this play,
mm-hmm.
and and you know the interest in it, the play probably would have been put on and may have had contained to the students who are attending the school. Now everyone is involved. More people in the community involved want to know more about the play and why this is even an issue at all.
The play does involve a lesbian relationship. Claire Goforth, you know, I think what we need to take note of in discussing this is that Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, for many years, has been a refuge for kids who are different, kids who are creative, kids who are gay or lesbian or non-binary, trans. It is a place where kids like that can really feel comfortable, can feel a sense of community. And so and full disclosure, both of my children have attended that school. And so the decision to cancel the play, at least when you look at the social media postings of some of the students, was gutting. They feel as though their identities are under attack.
I'm sure they do. It sends a message that you're not welcome and you're not accepted here. And it's really particularly galling because Douglas Anderson, as you say, has long been a refuge for students who are LGBTQ. And Paula Vogel, the playwright, she has said that if she's never had any problem with giving permission for a production to change it from a kiss to holding hands to appease the audience. And, you know, we're in an environment.
The play The Children's Hour has been performed, not to cut you off,
no,
for many, many years. And the subtext of that play, of course, was a relationship between two women.
Right. I mean, Oedipus Rex seems to be fine to perform. Romeo and Juliet, which features a sexual relationship between teenagers. But the only difference is that it's heterosexual. Of course, in Oedipus Rex, I'll just not get into that. You can look it up on your own time. But, I mean, the arts push boundaries. The arts, they show us, you know, they shine a light on the different facets of society and the ongoing conversation. And by stifling that, you're sending a terrible message that LGBTQ kids, your story isn't valid, you're not valid. And I think that I feel very comfortable saying that that is just wrong.
549-2937. Lindsay on the South Side. Go ahead, Lindsay.
Hi, Melissa. I'm a 10-year recent graduate of, well, I guess 10 years ago isn't recent, but I graduated in 2010.
Okay.
And I went to Douglas Anderson for writing. And now my little brother goes there. He's 16 and he goes there for writing too.
Mm-hmm.
And this censorship is just part of a really worrying trend I've heard from him over the last few years. Staff and teachers and administration not standing up for the students and instead putting parents and local politics first. And it's really disappointing to see. It wasn't like this when I went there 10 years ago.
Right. Yeah, we touched on that, Lindsay. Thank you for that. Mike Mendenhall, you know, you do have to ask why they greenlit the production at all, only to then cancel it if there were these concerns. And then also, this is happening in a context of books being pulled out of school libraries all over Florida, including here. New College of Florida, a liberal arts school in Sarasota, has become the latest lightning rod as the governor announces he's going to appoint all new board members at that school, which is also seen as a progressive school and a haven for LGBT kids. And the attempt, as he has stated, his office has stated, is to reform New College into a more Christian conservative school. So this goes beyond Douglas Anderson and the latest controversy at DA. This is something that we're seeing play out across the state.
Yeah, Melissa. And I think, too, you know, Governor DeSantis has made it pretty clear that he is aware that other states in the throughout the country that have a Republican governor or a Republican controlled state house he wants them to look to Florida as a model, like for how to run a conservative government. So you're already starting to see, as the legislative sessions for different states across the country are coming up, versions of the Don't Say Gay bill popping up in other state legislatures. I know my home state of Iowa, a bill was recently announced a couple days ago that was very similar to the Don't Say Gay bill here in Florida. So I think that, you know, these moves are, you know, are definitely a way that DeSantis is going to try to remake higher education in more of a conservative or Republican ideology. That's you know, pretty clear. And I think too, just to kind of expand a little bit on you know, censorship in high school, students throughout history have often exercised their freedom of speech to speak out against things that they don't agree with. Now you have social media that makes that even more clear. So, I mean, any time that you see this kind of censorship, whether it's pulling a play, you know, pulling literature, like I know in high school, I read The Scarlet Letter, I read, you know, and that was back in 2000, I graduated in 2003, you know, so, you know, you're going to start to see this, you know, the students have a megaphone like they've never had before. So that's, I think that's, it's going to constantly amplify.
Peter, tweets the show, so scantily clad car hops are allowed, but not two women kissing. Okay, Nate Monroe, you know, what's so ironic about this whole thing is that the play Indecent is about the evils of censorship.
Right.
That's the whole theme of the play.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of irony there. You know, I think there's appropriately been a lot of discussion about kind of the larger political context in the state, which is hostile toward, you know, LGBT students. And, you know, I think at this point, I mean, there have been a few incidents in the past where the district, I think, has seemed to overreact a bit. And I was a little bit willing to give them the benefit of the doubt that, you know, part of the culture in the state now and the kind of legal framework is that there are some really vague laws that encourage districts to kind of over enforce things. But this has gone too far. I mean, let the state demand that the play get pulled. Like, why? I don't understand at this point why school officials here are going out of their way to do stuff like this. I mean, the parents signed off on this play. What have we heard from the governor more than anything? Like, parents know best, right? Well, the parents were fine with this play. I mean, if the state has a problem with it, let the state come in and do that. I don't see why district officials are doing the state's dirty work for them. I just, at this point, I think that they're going far beyond what's necessary to protect the district's interests.
As you said earlier, Charles, we are seeing these kinds of incidents as educators go out of their way to avoid any right. issue, any concern with state officials cracking down on them, maybe threatening to pull school funding.
And in the process, making it more of an issue than it actually is. Because, you know, we probably wouldn't have heard of this play. It would have been just another exercise at Douglas Anderson that it came and went.
Well, let me ask you though, with new school board members seated in Jacksonville who are far more conservative, maybe not. Maybe some of them had raised concerns. There's no way to know for sure.
Yeah, I just have a hard time believing that every school board member is kind of sort of clocking everything that goes on at every school. You know, given the reputation of Douglas Anderson to be, you know, one of the most creative schools in the country. I mean, they have a reputation for, you know, for pushing the envelope and being on the edge. They also have a reputation for putting a lot of people in the industry, in the very in the arts industries that are very successful. Mm-hmm. And so this, you know, this school is really one of the training grounds for, you know, some of the people who we know throughout this country who are doing really well. So no reason to stifle that, especially like Nate said, if the parents signed off on it, you know, let the kids, you know, do their play.
Let us know your thoughts. 549-2937. Tom on the West Side. Hello, Tom.
Good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to point out that the Seagull has some mature themes as well. It's got suicide attempts, the suicide, and romantic triangles. So apparently it's just some mature themes they're concerned about.
Thanks for that. Yeah, that is the production that's being done now in place of Indecent. Okay. Before we talk about the big game this weekend, Duval, everybody, we've all got our Jaguars gear on, as I've been shamelessly promoting. Let's talk for a minute about the fact that Martin Luther King Day is coming up Monday. you came this morning from a Martin Luther King breakfast, Charles. And this is the fourth year in a row, I believe, that the city of Jacksonville has had dueling MLK breakfasts.
Yeah.
This began when Mayor Lenny Curry came to odds with the planners of the long-running MLK breakfast in Jacksonville for decades, because he and his administration felt that the speakers they'd booked were, I guess, a little too woke. So now what we see are two dueling breakfasts, one put on, I believe, still by the local NAACP, yeah, one by the city of Jax.
Yeah.
So that happened today.
It's happening today. I just came directly here from the city's breakfast. Nice crowd. The NAACP's breakfast is virtual. It's amazing that we have, you know, such a, you know, welcoming and unifying city, but we can't, you know, this thing traditionally, the beauty of it was done in unison with, you know, with all parties together. I just believe that at this point, we're probably going to need to have new players at the table to get this done on all sides, perhaps, have a unified breakfast to do this.
Yeah, I mean,
as a community.
The whole idea of MLK was preaching love over hate, bringing people together, racial and economic justice. So it is unfortunate that this continues. Claire.
It is. I believe I was at the last breakfast that was unified. And I think that Mayor Curry got his feelings hurt and his feathers ruffled a bit at that breakfast by some of the things that were said on the stage. And
then, what was said that was remember?
I don't. It's been several years now. And I don't think that wasn't anything that was like really an attack, a direct attack, so much it was questioning the status quo.
Okay.
And saying, let's have a little bit more of, you know, equality in Jacksonville, and acknowledging that we still have some way to go. But, you know, this is, come on, guys, let's just come together again. Hopefully a new administration and maybe some new voices at the table, like Charles said, can really return us to where we should be with this. Let's go back to the spirit of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Mike.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think that, you know, if you know, with the city council, with as many people that are terming out and with the districts going, you are going to have a new, almost a new city council, a new city government. So that, you know, that might be, you know, that might be coming back to the table. You know, we'll see what happens there. But I think that, I think that you're right, Melissa, that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr., you know, he tried to be a unifier. He wanted to bring people to come together. And I think that, I think that that's the least the city of Jacksonville can do is to bring it back.
Yeah. Nate Monroe, you know, this dueling MLK breakfast scenario is sort of emblematic of a lot of the themes you write about in your column when it comes to issues in this city, racial divisions, economic divisions, frustration with our political and civic leadership. It's all kind of part of the same big piece.
Yeah, I mean, it's these dueling breakfasts are a good encapsulation of, I think, a lot of problems that Jacksonville struggles with. One thing that kind of has stood out to me about the city's MLK breakfast the last several years, including this year, is that the city really likes to book these keynote speakers who have this sort of anodyne, kind of like Tony Robbins-esque kind of background and message. Like it's just very kind of like not in my mind, maybe the kind of message that like civil rights groups are terribly interested in on Martin Luther King Day, and not something that's super aligned with, I think, you know, what Martin Luther King's words and beliefs were. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was considered in his time like an agitator by a lot of people, and he was a disruptor and told a lot of people things they didn't want to hear. And, you know, and so I think like part of this rift is that the city is just like not interested in booking speakers who are going to tell the elected officials things about their city and about maybe life generally that you know, they just that don't fit this kind of neat, nice, we're all getting along narrative.
Mm-hmm. As we talk about this, we continue to get feedback from listeners about the Douglas Anderson story. Here's an email from Gary. I'm the father of a gay son and a non-binary stepchild. I believe the cries of censorship are overblown. Schools are not the free market, and a degree of censorship is acceptable in order to respect the rights of parents whose kids are required to attend. He says, thank you for that. Okay, let's talk about a story, that rare story, that can unify everyone in town. Yes, the Jacksonville Jaguars. Happy playoff eve, everybody. The Jaguars will be dripping in teal and white on Saturday night in their playoff matchup against the Los Angeles Chargers. In support of our reigning AFC South champions, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry is asking all of Duval to wear Jaguars gear this Friday. Yes, it is January 13th, Friday the 13th. Mercury is in retrograde, too, so that's not good. But go Jags! It's tomorrow night, 8:15 p.m. at TIAA Bank Field. The big game will broadcast on NBC. Most of us here in the studio are all decked out in our Jaguars gear. Thank you, producer Heather Schatz, for my Jaguar scarf. Clear go forth for everyone that's watching on video. What is that thing on your head? Claire, by the way, Claire and her husband were seen on national television last week at the Jaguars-Titans game, all decked out in their Duval gear. What are you wearing?
So I'm wearing a Jaguar hoodie here. I believe you can purchase this for yourself from Walmart.
Nice.
Very fancy, very fancy. Thank you, Mom, for this. Shout out, Nancy Goforth. So, very excited for the game tomorrow. Will not be in attendance, unfortunately, so they will be missing one good luck charm. But, you know, last week they gave us the River City revenge against the Tennessee Titans. And this week, what I'm hoping for is the Bold City blowout. All right. And we get a Bold City
blowout.
They
should hire you to do some of their marketing, my friend.
That's all right. I'll stay on the light side so that people can do the marketing.
Okay. Who wants to chime in here? Saturday marks the Jaguars' fifth home postseason game and the first since they defeated the Buffalo Bills in January of 2018. Head coach Doug Peterson, beloved by the team and the city. Nate, you're a pretty active member of the so-called Bold City Brigade. How excited are you?
Yeah, this is going to be a super fun game. I will definitely be out there tailgating, having a good time. I feel like the Jags are on a roll. I mean, I really expect them to beat the Chargers. You know, they did earlier this season. The Chargers are a bit different now and should be a bit better. They were really plagued with injuries when we played them earlier in the season, but I don't know. I mean, this team just feels charmed, and it feels like they're going to go a bit
actually,
deeper into
not
the
wood.
Playoffs.
I hope so. Charles, the halftime entertainment will be courtesy of New York-based pop rock band American Authors. Their big hit, Best Day of My Life. You've all heard that. And then Tedeschi Trucks will perform the Star Spangled Banner. Of course, Guitar Hero Paul Wayne was here yesterday. He did the honors last week. And so it's an exciting weekend, going to be a cold weekend.
Yeah, pulling out all the stops. I said on this show, I guess during preseason, that I wouldn't take this team seriously until they won 7 games. So they've exceeded my expectations, and I don't want to do any harm by picking them to win. So we'll just hope that they, you know, keep the ball rolling, so to speak, and win tomorrow.
Yeah, and everybody wear their teal. By the way, we've got this other really cool little piece of Jaguar swag. Let me hold it up for people watching on video. Yeah. It was always the Jags. Here it is. Everybody needs to be all decked out today and tomorrow.
All right.
Mike.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed the most is that the Jaguars, like this season compared to last season, they look like they're having fun. They actually look like they're having a good time out there. They're playing like a team. And I think they actually believed that they could do it. You know, last year, you know, there was so much, you know, drama with Urban Meyer and issues with, you know, with their kicker. And I just think that, you know, I really think this year they really believe that they could do it. They're having a good time out there. And, you know, and you listen to the national commentators and they're all saying that, look, this team is hot. So,
go Jaguars, get after it. And before we say goodbye, let's go around the horn and round up stories you might have missed this week. Yes, it's our lightning round, everybody. going to be cold this weekend. City Rescue Mission will increase its overnight capacity and extend its hours to those in need of shelter. Other shelters are doing the same. So whether you're at the game or not, bundle up. Charles Griggs.
Yeah, it's MLK weekend, but we still need to call attention to rounding out the city's murder rate last year, 163. We're already off to a fast start with about 6 homicides this year.
Claire, go for it.
The city of Jacksonville is giving $10 million to raise power lines across the river. That's a pretty big story.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I did see that. Thank you for that. Mike Mendenhall.
Yeah, and so Daly's Place, our Daly's fuel station has a new concept for a two-story mixed-use gas station with a rooftop bar and grill in La Villa. The Downtown Development Review Board was not too keen on the design. They're saying it doesn't really fit with the neighborhood and with what the, you know, the effort to restore the historic Black neighborhood of La Villa. So they're sending it to a workshop.
Nate Monroe.
Claire poached mine a little bit, but I will say that my colleague David Bauerlein is a good story about the $10 million that the port is getting for the power lines, even as their Asian cargo numbers fell, which is kind of an interesting twist on their everything is great narrative.
Thanks for that. And thanks to all four of you for being here. Charles Griggs, Claire Goforth, Nate Monroe, and Mike Mendenhall. Go Jaguars. Have fun this weekend, everybody. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, Melissa. Thanks, right. Go Jags.
When we come back, NASA and NOAA sound the alarm about Earth's changing climate. That's next.
On the next Fresh Air, an archive interview with novelist Russell Banks. He died Sunday. As New York Times obit said, his vivid portrayals of working-class Americans grappling with issues of poverty, race, and class placed him among the first ranks of contemporary novelists. His novels, The Sweet Hereafter and Affliction, were adapted into films. Join us.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
After lying about who he was and where he worked, calls grow for Long Island's George Santos to resign.
He's a national joke, he's an international joke, but this joke's gotta go.
Next time on The Roundup, aides to the president find another set of classified documents, a damaged database causes air travel chaos, and California prepares for more rain as storms wreak havoc along the West Coast.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, for decades now, NASA and NOAA have been keeping careful watch on Earth's changing climate. Every year, they release an update to the hottest years on record. And yesterday, they added the year 2022 to the books. On the line now to talk more about that work and just how hot the previous year was, we welcome Dr. Wendy Bohan, a NASA Earth scientist based at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Dr. Bohan, good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for letting me talk to you today.
So NASA and NOAA are out with the latest global temperature data for 2022. Where does the year rank for the hottest years on record?
2022 is the fifth hottest year on record. It's tied for that dubious honor with 2015. So we're continuing to see the upward warming trend that we've been observing for many decades now.
Yeah, not surprising, but certainly alarming. And anyone who's been following this knows that it's part of a much larger climate trajectory. Can you talk a little bit about where you sit at NASA, how you're monitoring how these changes, this warming planet, is going to impact people, impact society, what we can expect?
Absolutely. So we have a fleet of satellites. You know, people think that NASA just studies space, but the Earth is also a planet. And we spend a lot of time and energy focusing on our one precious world. And so all of these satellites are monitoring the global health of the Earth. We look at the atmosphere, the biosphere, the animals and plants. We look at the oceans, the ice caps, And what we're seeing is that all of these systems are being impacted by global warming, the planet getting hotter. This has severe potential consequences for humanity. And actually, we're seeing that already. The climate crisis is here. We're seeing it in intensified rainfall events, increased tropical storms. So things like Hurricane Ian, that was a really powerful storm just this past year. We're seeing more droughts, more flooding, greater intensity of wildfires. So all of the weather events that we're seeing are related to climate change, and we can expect to see these continue into the future. So climate change and the way that the world is warming is going to touch every person on this planet.
Absolutely right. And here in Florida, of course, we're particularly close to this, given our vulnerabilities and how much coastline we have, along with the potential for inland flooding. For people listening right now here in Florida in particular, what are your thoughts about how our quality of life is going to be affected? Real estate along the coast, that's going to be a big concern, and other problems.
Right. Florida is particularly vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. So, you know, we're going to have higher intensity hurricanes. There will be more inland flooding, like you mentioned. We know that the Arctic is warming 3 to 4 times faster than the rest of the planet. And so that has implications for sea level rise as that ice is melting. So that obviously impacts you there in Florida. So a lot of the effects that are going to happen, Florida's a little bit of the canary in the coal mine. You're going to be seeing those impacts more and sooner than other people. And so it's important that we think about how we can create resilient communities that can deal and adapt to the changes that have already happened, but also how can we mitigate, you know, future impacts. The good news, there is good news. We know what is causing global warming, you know, the removal of fossil fuels from the earth and then the burning of those to create greenhouse gases is what's causing this. And once we know the problem, we can find a solution. So we just all need to start working together as a global community, individual communities, family communities, to mitigate the future effects of climate change so that we can arrest this continued warming.
Let me plug our website, adaptflorida.org, where we cover these trends in Florida. And we do look at how the state is already starting to adapt. But as you say, Wendy, mitigation is so important. What's one thing people, the average citizen, can do to do their part in the solution, and which, of course, is decarbonizing this planet?
Right. We want to get to net zero. And then we want to go beyond that. And a lot of that is going to be big corporations. A lot of that's going to be government initiatives. But we each individually can really make a difference by small choices that we make. If you can take public transportation rather than driving your own car, if you can cut back a little bit on air travel, make sure that you're eating sustainably. You know, we often, when we think of climate change, think about all of the things we have to give up. But if we can reframe that and think about all of the ways that we can make the world better by just making different choices. You know, eating better, we can be healthier. Riding your bike or walking more often will lead to, you know, increased mood, better health. So there's lots of things, individual small choices that we can make that add up over time. So I would encourage everybody, you know, to visit your website, to go to the nasa.gov/earth website to find out more about what you can do to help individually mitigate climate change, and also to talk to your representatives to encourage them to really think about how we as a global community are addressing these issues.
And as you said, people tend to think of NASA as the space agency, but you are a leader in this climate space. How do you see NASA's role going forward?
So, you know, you go to the doctor and they run a lot of tests to assess your health. I feel like the role that NASA has is we have satellites, we have ground-based measurements, and we're using the information that we gather from that to assess the global health of the Earth. And then if we can figure out what's wrong, what the problem is, we can start to work with other organizations, work with communities and governments to choose the right solutions. So we are not just putting a lot of effort into things that aren't going to work. We have to really understand the problem in order to find the right solution. And I feel like NASA and NOAA can help to guide that effort with our global monitoring efforts.
Thank you so much for being with us. She's Dr. Wendy Bohan.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Dr. Wendy Bohan, NASA Earth Scientist. She's based at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. And that's our show. Thanks to David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Brendan Rivers, Isabella DeSilva, Michelle Corum, and all of you. Join me again today at noon with my co-host Matthew Petty for the Florida Roundup, our live statewide call-in program rounding up the biggest stories from all across the state. That's at noon. Go Jaguars! Duval! Everybody, have fun this weekend and stay warm.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.